morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to start off our program today with talking to old friends, which is something we really like to do.
Yeah. These are really old friends.
Yeah, it goes back a long time. The Noninos, Antonella.
If we'd been around as long as they had, we'd be well over 100 years old.
Well, you're not talking about Elisabetta and Antonella.
No. It's the Nonino Distillery, however you pronounce it in Italian, has been in existence since 1897, quite a long time. And the amazing thing about it is that over 100 years or more, they've just gotten better and better and better and more interesting. And it's always a delight to have the chance to talk to them. And
they're having some big
120
yeah,
years.
Yeah, and then the celebration. Well, we talk about that with the foundation, the awards.
Let's just let them loose.
They know they can speak for themselves. Antonella Nonino and Elisabetta Nonino. A name synonymous with the great grappa in this world is Nonino, and we're lucky to have our good friends Antonella and Elisabetta Nonino on the phone, and they're having a happy celebration. You too, Antonella, you are on the phone. You are celebrating. Your family has been in the grappa business for 120 years?
Yes, because in 1897, our great-great-grandfather Orazio Nonino, that is the family founder, established in the village close to our distillery, Ronchi di Percotto, the premises of the distillery Nonino, which till that moment existed as an itinerant still assembled on wheels. And so we celebrate this special year because since 120 years we distill grappa 100% with our seasonal method, with a discontinuous batch still. And till nowadays is the family that run the pot still and that follow all the different moments of the production of grappa. So we are very, we are completely involved. It is really an art of a family, a heart of family.
Yeah, well, we have been there, and we have seen your family and had lunch with your family at the distillery, and what fun we had, and what wonderful product you have as well. Now, there have been changes in how you distill your grappa over the years. Tell us the change, the big change that your father made.
In 1973... Giannola and Benito, our parents, as they were running the distillery, they realized that grappa was considered a poor distillate for countryside people. They started to make experiments, and in 1973, they created the Monovitigno grappa, starting with the picolit, which is the grappa that we obtained from the distillation of single variety of leftover wines. And the Grappa Nonino Monovitigno is really unbelievable because it's fresh, pure, and with the scent and the aroma of the vine of origin.
And smooth. I mean, when I was a student in Firenze, the grappa was rough. It was awful. And now we had an entire lunch with you where you matched each course but one to grappa.
Oh, thank you. Because the grappa Nonino, you are right, is really smooth, elegant. And for example, I'm thinking about the Monovitigno Moscato that is perfect in if you want to pair with fish with some appetizer, and it is really fantastic also to prepare the Nonino tonic, that is the long drink that we created in 2008, because Giannola, our mother, has always been involved with cocktails, and with because with Grappa Nonino, it is really like a new world to discover, that she has been experimenting since many, many years. I'm thinking about, for example, Mauro Lotti in Roma, that is, or Salvatore Calabrese, and really the Nonino Grappa cocktails give you the idea how you can handle with, at the same time, tradition with innovation, maintaining the purity of our production.
Now, you're having another celebration coming up on the 27th of January, and let's talk about that in just a moment. But I wanted to ask a question. In reading the program for that day, it mentions a Nonino aperitif. Now, is that the same as a Nonino tonic, or is it different?
It is something very special that Elisabetta would be very pleased to tell you.
Okay, Elisabetta, tell us.
Yes, we will start to celebrate the Nonino Prize with the Aperitivo Nonino that is based on the Amaro Nonino. It's something really fantastic, and also it's very easy to prepare at home by yourself, because you need just ice, a slice of orange, and Amaro Nonino.
Amarino.
Quintessenza, yes. And if you like to have it in a granola style, you just can add some bubbles that could be Italian or of all over the world, and so it is really perfect for any other country to be tasted, and it is very, very light.
Now, we've been talking, of course, so far about things to drink. But there's another area where the Nonino family has been innovative, and that is the different prizes that you've been awarding since the middle of the 1970s. Can you tell us more about those three things where you're going to make the announcement of the awards on the 27th of January?
With great pleasure, because Giannone Benito, after distilling the Monotino Picolite, they were looking for other autochthonous native variety from Friuli, and they discovered that the native one, like Schioppettino, Pignolo, and in a different way, Ribolla Gialla, were disappearing. So in order to preserve the biodiversity of the territory, and to obtain the official authorization to replant this variety, they established the Nonino Residual Prize, which means gold vine shot. And with years, not only they preserved the biodiversity of Friuli Venezia Giulia, but they also started to dedicate very, very much importance to the values of the rural culture. And in the years, they enlarged the prize to a literary section that nowadays represents in Italy one of the most important international literature prizes. The president of the jury is the Nobel Prize Vidya Naipaul, and the jury is composed by John Benville, Peter Brook, Antonio Damasio, Edgar Moren, Claudio Magri, Sermano Olmi. And this year we will deliver the prize to the important writer from Albania, Ismail Kadare, and to the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben, that is renewed all over the world. And beside, we have the beautiful Nonino Residual Prize that will be awarded to the Onlus Project, a poll that has been created 2 years ago by seven bartenders, Alex Gratena, Monica Berg, Simone Caporale, Jörg Meyer, Jean Min, and that really decided to focus. They have they are looking for knowledge, and they are young, but they are very respectful of what are the values of every society. They decided also to organize every year a symposium dedicated to discuss important subject of nowadays life, like gender, and this year they will be dedicated to purity. And beside the symposium, where they invite the bartender community to discuss about this important subject in order really to grow within the society, they also created a pool project Amazonia in order to save a special root of manioca that is in Amazonia, in this Bora community, and together with the University of Lima, they will created 44 houses for these people, in order they can grow and they can, in a way, to have more sustainability about inside their community, and also they give them some important information about commercial subject, in order that they can save an ancient tradition of their community, and at the same time in order to survive, but to survive in a, to grow in a beautiful way. Sorry, my English is
terrible.
I hope you understand how we are happy that young bartender, they, together with their own business, they put very much attention to what is substantiability, respect, and to knowledge in order to grow within their community.
Now, your intention is really global, isn't it? I mean, you have a global influence. Your perspective is worldwide.
Yes, because are the same values that are at the base of the Nonino family and the Nonino production. As you know, we take care of the distillation of grappa personally, and we distill 100% with the artisanal batch distillation, and all our grappa are without adding colors, so it's all natural. In order to go towards a better, in a way, a better world, respectful of our tradition, of our work, and so we are very happy that also within our world there are some young people that have the same vision and needs to be support for that.
Now you're producing two other things that we haven't talked about yet that I think are unusual. One is your spirit called Ue.
Yes.
And the other is grappa, which is aged, and in some cases aged for quite a long time. So
the beauty is that it's a family tradition to age grappa, because in the respect of the law that exists since 1951, Nonino Distillery always had the cellar under control of the government, sealed. So we are able to give the ID of all the grappa that we age. And this is the fact that we are so proud that in all Grappa Nonino age, you can find for how long was age. And as more long is the aging, and more detail you have on the label, till arriving to the Grappa 22 years that it's bottled in the only 883 bottle to celebrate the 120th anniversary. It's the only grappa aged 22 years, the longer aging that you can find on the market, on the global market. And speaking about the Ue, that is a new spirit. street created by Giannale and Benito Nonino in November 1984. Until 85, only Nonino Distillery had a temporary authorization to produce it, and only in 1986 came out a law for everybody that say, under request of Nonino Distillery, now it's possible to distill the entire grape, that we call Uwe, that means grape in Friuli language, and it's a fantastic spirit, different from the grappa, because it's much more smoother, because it came from a so rich raw material, included also the liquid part. Starting from the grape, there are many different spirits that you can have. You can have grappa distilling the leftover, the pomace. You can have brandy and cognac in French distilling the wine. You can have pisco distilling only the liquid part after the pressing in South America. And you can have ue, that Nonino created in 1984, distilling the entire grape considered as an eau de vie fruit distillate. And also for the ue, we created a cellar in 1987, in March, to see what would be the result of the aging this new spirit. And we are very proud and happy that now on the market you can find single barrels that we open one per year. And as this year, there is a 27-year age Uwe grape distillate.
Wow.
And we declare the kind of wood, the number of the barrel that was open, how many liters were produced, how many bottles, and the number of the bottle on the bottle itself.
Where do we get some of that? That sounds really good.
Yeah, and this is for us very important because rules for grappa in Italy and so in Europe are very bad, and Nonino want to be transparent, and so when you buy a Nonino product, you know, reading the label, that you are sure of what you are drinking, because by law you can print on the label, produce and bottle with your name, and you just do in the bottling. And we granted with the Nonino name that everything has Nonino on the bottle, on the label, is produced and bottled in Nonino Distillery, following the artisanal way of distillation, and not only, but for all the age Nonino product, grappa and ue, we never add the color or caramel as rules allow to do in any spirit. And so all our age spirits are just the result of the pure aging.
Now, how do people get more information? What is your website so that people can
get more information? And
it's grappanonino.it.
Okay, great. And here's another thing, listeners, and it's a tribute to Nonino and what has happened with the demand for grappa. You can tell the quality of a cocktail bar you go to if they have Nonino grappa on the shelf.
Yes. and even the bottles are beautiful. Everything is just so refined. And you can tell the quality of Nonino just by how it's presented. And we love you, all of you, your family. And I'm so happy that we're able to share this with our listeners about your anniversary particularly. And thank you again for all the conversations we've had this morning.
Thank you. Thanks to you. Thanks a lot. Thank you, Peter. Thank you. And thank you. We wait for you in Friuli.
Oh, I know.
We need to
come back
and see us.
Yes, indeed. Miss you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.
Ciao. It sure would be fun to be there for those celebrations that they talk about, but I guess we can't be in Friuli, Venezia Giulia every week, even though it seems like a good idea.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea to me.
Anyway, believe it or not, the next segment There is actually a connection to Grappa, yes. Even a connection to Nonino Grappa. But we're going to keep you in suspense, so you have to listen and see if you can figure out where the connection is.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Welcome back, everybody. And we're going to throw out the challenge right now that we hinted at before the break. See if you can figure out where there's a connection between the previous track.
We say it in the interview.
Well, they have to be paying attention to it. They have to be paying attention.
Well, anybody who's been listening to this show for a long time knows that I have this mad association for some reason with snails.
Yeah, right.
Why I got? I don't know why.
She has a mad association with Grappa too. But
yeah,
that's another story.
Indeed.
Why don't we just fire Taylor up and let him go?
Right. Well, I've already been talking at length with Taylor Knapp, who is called the chief snail wrangler.
head snail wrangler.
head. Snail wrangler. And your website is very amusing. It's very witty. Peconic escargot, right?
Peconic escargot.
Let's spell that so people can go on the website.
Peconic escargot. And it's named Peconic because that's, the farm kind of butts up right against the Peconic Bay, which on the east end of Long Island, New York.
Okay, and it's escargotnos. .com. And you sell a very rare product, actually, which is fresh snails. They've not been frozen. They've not been canned. I guess regulations are you can't sell them live anymore, but this is as close to live as you can get, huh?
That's the idea, yeah. We're very kind of chef and home cook foodie driven, and we thought if we could give people a live product, we would, but unfortunately the government has other things in mind, so yeah, we wanted to get as close to that live product as possible. So they are fresh, not frozen or canned. It's a raw product which allows the chef or home cook to kind of infuse flavor at the beginning of the cooking process however they'd like, rather than starting with something that's already pre-cooked and maybe it's already been stewed in some kind of a dock or a court bouillon or something like that. So because these are raw and fresh, it's really kind of starting at ground zero with how you choose to prepare and flavor them. Yeah.
Now, you worked in a restaurant. You're our chef?
Yeah, and we still do. Yeah, I have a pop-up restaurant that we do on most Saturday nights on the North Fork of Long Island called Paw Paw. And then before that, I was at a couple restaurants also on Long Island and Providence, and I spent some time at Noma and a place called Azurmendi in Spain. And a few restaurants in New York. So kind of a little bit of everything.
But you figured out you were sourcing all of your products locally and fresh, and you went on and did a major search, and there was not a single other person providing fresh snails in this country, the whole country, right?
That's exactly right, yeah. It was such a crazy thought to think that nobody was doing this, and after a lot of research, we came to the realization that there was really nobody in the country that was providing fresh snails. And so once we saw this huge gap in the market, the next step was to try and figure out why and if it would be possible for us to fill it.
Yeah, no, it's not easy raising snails.
You would know, right?
Well, I know. I mean, my
you know about it. Huh?
My family used to buy them live and feed them. I think it was oatmeal, right? And so they purged themselves.
You could feed them oatmeal. We feed them. We finish them on spent grain, actually, from some of the local breweries. But our main kind of feed for them is a lot of foraged grains. So kind of like dark bitter grains that are already growing around. But you're right. They are a difficult thing to to grow because they're a pretty finicky species. They have a very kind of small range for ideal temperature and humidity and exactly what they will and won't eat. They grow very slowly, you know, in comparison to some other creatures their size. And then there's just not a lot of information out there about how to raise them. So a lot of what we did was trial and error. And we're still figuring things out as we go. I'm certainly not a snail expert. There's a lot of people out there that know a lot more about it than I do. So we're still learning.
There are lots of help sites for people trying to grow them, like poor farmers in South America.
Now, humor me for just a second, Taylor. I sort of know what a pig farm looks like, and I know what a cow farm looks like, and I know what a sheep farm looks like, but what does a snail farm look like exactly?
Yeah. Well, ours looks very different from your typical snail farm, and that was part of our challenge. The snail farms in Europe are mostly outdoor pen. They are kind of fenced in, and then they're covered with netting to kind of keep birds away and maybe cut back on some of the wind and rain. But for the most part, they're outdoor operations, and ours could not be outdoors. The USDA prohibited that. We had to have a contained space for them.
Oh, really? They're in that
right.
way, aren't they?
Well, I was going to say, so ours is inside of a greenhouse, and to my knowledge, there's no one else really raising their snails in a greenhouse, for better or for worse. That's what we decided to put these things in. There are some indoor, large indoor snail operations, but we have really the only greenhouse operation to my knowledge. So, yeah, it's a greenhouse with essentially a stacking shelving system inside, and so the snails are contained in these pens, these kind of tubs almost, and they're very kind of sectioned off. So that way we can kind of closely monitor their age and what they're eating. If there's any sort of issues or diseases that outbreak, it only affects maybe a couple hundred rather than thousands of products.
Have you ever seen them do their little dance before they mate?
Oh, yes. Oh, we've seen
what
a lot
does it
of
look
that,
like? I've seen videos of it.
I mean, everything happens very slowly and oftentimes at night because they're nocturnal animals. So, but yeah, they'll kind of move around each other and
they kiss.
Yeah, they do. They kind of curl up on themselves, especially when things get really kind of humid and wet in there. It's kind of strange. And then in the morning, if we're lucky, we'll find love darts. I don't know if you know about
the love
darts.
Yeah, I do, but you better explain it to our listeners. I do know about that, believe it or not.
So the love darts are it is exactly what it sounds like. It's a calcified barbed spear that these snails will kind of launch into their mating partner. And they haven't really decided exactly
what is it, so they don't get away or what?
No, they think it's kind of helped with arousal of some kind. There wasn't any, there's still, the jury is out on exactly what they're for, but they're actually, I mean, they're large enough to be seen and held in your hand. I mean, they're about a quarter of an inch to even a half inch long, and it just looks like a little kind of white toothpick. But in the morning, we'll go in, and we'll be sorting through the bins, and we can find these things kind of still sticking out of the snails, and we know that they had quite a night.
No, they change sex, don't they?
They're hermaphrodites. Yeah, they can. They could even self fertilize if they wanted to. We haven't witnessed that, but it apparently can happen. So
they'd have to be pretty gymnastic to do that, I guess.
You better get a little flashlight and get in there. And
I know.
Check out what's going
on.
Well,
we have to give them some privacy. So
oh, you do. Okay. You mean they won't do it if somebody's watching?
That's right. Yeah.
It's funny.
Well, but that's what
and we were in the fruit and vegetable market in Valencia in Spain, and they did have live snails for sale, but the snails were attempting a breakout.
Oh no!
So they were sort of climbing on one another's backs to see if anybody could get out, but somehow they would get close to the brink of the bin they were in, and then they would all fall down.
Oh jeez. No. Yeah, we've heard stories about people that used to get them in the markets, and they would take them home and put them in a pot, you know, just to kind of clean them, and then they'd walk away, and they'd come back, and there were snails all over their kitchen.
Oh, yeah. We did that with crabs once in South Carolina or North Carolina. We caught some crabs, live crabs, and put them in our neighbor's bathtub when they were out.
geez.
And they must have climbed in each other, but when they came home, they were all over the house.
Oh, man. Yep. Yep. Got to keep an eye on them.
So tell us how you sell these now. People order them off your website, huh?
That's right. Yeah, the home cook could order them off the website, and we ship them right to your door, FedEx, overnight, so they'd get there the next day or 2 days. If you're a local, you could come and pick them up at the farm. But we sell in shell and out of shell. So the in shell is sold by the dozen, and the out of shell is sold by the pound or quarter pound, however you'd like it. Yeah.
So and you have recipes on your website.
We do. Yeah, we're working on developing some more. We've got kind of a challenge ahead of us to do two things. One of them is maybe inspire a chef that takes a look at the website with a recipe that's a little more unusual and kind of gets his brain juices flowing. And then we also have to have recipes on there that can easily be made at home for maybe a less experienced home cook. So we're working on kind of playing both sides of that there and making sure there's lots of fun, interesting things, but also some things that are, you know, very easy to prepare at home.
Yeah. Well, you should use our Nonino Guapa recipe because that worked very well with the herbal quality and the earthy quality of your snails.
Oh, we should add that. I'll try it out first. But yeah, we'd love to give that suggestion. That's a great idea.
Now, there's a very famous snail recipe that you need to try to get, which is called snail porridge.
Oh yeah, Heston Blumenthal.
Snail porridge was invented by the legendary chef
Heston Blumenthal.
Blumenthal of the Fat Duck in Bray, England.
Oh.
But here's how it came about. We asked him how it came about, and he said he was thinking about what to do with snails, recipe-wise, and then it suddenly dawned on him that they were using oats, like porridge oats,
to purge
for the snails to eat, and then purge themselves to clean them up. And wouldn't it be fun to simulate that by making a whole dish out of it? So indeed, it's like oatmeal, except it's green.
Yeah,
a very vivid green color, and then the snails are cooked in there.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, that'd be really nice. There's along the same line. Jose Andres is doing a recipe right now at his restaurant in D.C. I think it's Mini Bar.
Oh, yeah, it would be Mini Bar. What's he doing?
He's doing a dish called, it's called Fast and Slow or something like that, but essentially what it is it's snail caviar, which we don't have yet, but it's on the way, hopefully by March.
I wanted to ask you about that. What is snail caviar? It's on your website, and you're not.
Yeah, it's taking a little longer than we had hoped to get it ready, but it requires a lot of eggs. So it is the snail roe, the snail egg. So they burrow down into the soil about an inch or two, and they deposit anywhere between 50 and 100 eggs. And each snail will do that twice a year for the most part. It could be more often. And so we pull those eggs out of the soil, and we cure them and pack them up, and off they go. They have this great mushroomy, umami flavor. Obviously, they don't taste fishy at all because this is a land creature. So they're very earthy. They taste like carrots and kind of mossy and very woodsy. They'd be a great accompaniment for any sort of land product. So it could be, you know, whereas you'd put, fish caviar on an oyster or a lobster tail, the snail caviar would be wonderful on a piece of, you know, a really nice piece of beef, or even with carrots or roasted, you know, root vegetables or mushrooms or something like that.
So. Well, you ought to do with the Long Island duck, I guess, right?
That would be great with the duck. No,
yeah, that's a good idea.
You're right. Yep.
Yeah. So Jose's going to explore this. That's great.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. It's right now all of our egg production is going toward, well, we hatch them all for the escargot, so we really have to make sure we have enough before we can start setting some aside for caviar, and we're hoping by March we'll be ready to launch something like that.
Well, do you have a space where the snails could dig in their little pens and lay their eggs?
Yeah, the greenhouse is kind of divided with bins that have soil in them for laying and just for raising them. And then we have bins that are set aside just for purging because we need to get that dirt out of there. They eat a lot of dirt. They need the calcium in the soil to build their strong shells. So
that's why they need to be purged, huh?
Exactly, which is exactly why they need to be purged. So they get moved to bins that don't have anything in them, and we feed them just the spent grain to move the soil out and to kind of put something tasty, you know, back in, so to speak. But for the most part, for most of their lives, they're on that soil. Yeah, exactly.
Well, all the purchase information is on your website, both wholesale and retail. And just as you said they would, they arrived on a given day, and I had instructions saying that they should be refrigerated but could stay there before I cooked them for, I think it was 4 days?
Anywhere between 4 and 5, maybe 6 days at the most. I mean, you have to kind of, because it is a raw product, you have to kind of treat it as you would fresh fish. So if you're, you know, we send all of our shipments out on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and we hope that our, you know, our customers are cooking them by the weekend or so. If you're not going to cook them, then you know, it's best to put them in the freezer or even give them kind of like a park hook. But, yeah, treat it like you would fresh seafood, exactly.
Well, Taylor, it was so much fun, and it's a great experience. It's a great product, and you're right on trend because we're having a revival of interest in escargot. Guess what, huh?
That's right. I hope we're right there on the cusp of it, yeah. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
So were you paying attention? If you were paying attention, then you'll know that, in fact, there wasn't any cognac in the house to go into snail, so we used Nonino Grappa instead.
And it was tasted even better.
And now let's go on to a slightly different subject.
Well, now this next book is going to be an instant classic, and it's going to be an essential reference book in your library. It's called Pure Charcuterie, and I'll tell you, I've never seen anything so clearly explained in my whole life. This, of course, Meredith Lee is such a natural teacher, too. Meredith Lee, I'm going to read the entire title of your current book because it really is what the book's about. It's called Pure, which is highlighted in white, Charcuterie, and then subtitled, The Craft and Poetry of Curing Meats at Home. And I'm going to read one other thing, and that's one of the tributes, endorsements on the back of the book that says, I don't know of anyone that can make a description of making mortadella sound poetic, funny, emotionally engaging, and most importantly, to the point. And I think that pretty much sums up my evaluation of this book as well.
Now you made an admission before we went on the air about mortadella and bologna. Can you
My admission?
Yeah, you said it was really hard to make.
Oh, about mortadella.
Mortadella, because it is a technique requiring suspension.
That's right. So it's a suspension of meat and fat and liquid in, you know, a relatively, you know, in a way that you can't tell the difference between the meat and the fat and the liquid on your tongue.
Exactly.
And so, you know, from a culinary perspective, that's one of the more difficult things to do when it comes to meat processing, you know, and still have it look presentable. Now, and so I have respect for it for that reason alone.
Now, how did you learn all this?
Well, I kind of went at it in a backwards way. I've always been a cook, but I started out farming quite some time ago and was raising animals, so I was really specifically focused on the production of meat, but opened a butcher shop in, I guess, a few years back, which I'm not a part of it anymore, but opened it up and sort of learned butchery out of a necessity, and then became, because I've always been a cook and always been sort of, you know, I guess my brain's always functioned that way, was really attracted to the artistry of charcuterie. And so I began sort of learning that on the side and became really fascinated with it. Just, you know, how much the quality of the meat and the quality of the fat affected the outcome of the charcuterie product, and then how much the life and death of the animal feeding into that was, you know, also related. And so, you know, I just sort of went down the rabbit hole, as they say,
so,
and have been making cured meats ever since.
So you live near Asheville, North Carolina, and this is
that's
your,
right.
And this is your full time job.
Well, I work for a nonprofit organization also, where it's a farm.
Okay.
And so we do a lot of this work, sort of the production side of this type of work, for educational purposes and research purposes. So I'm working with animals on the ground as well as writing and cooking and touring around teaching about this stuff.
And you write poems too. I saw the one at the end. Is there a poem at the beginning? I don't remember.
Well, the same poem is at the beginning, but it's pictured and it's written on the side of the hog with a grease marker.
Oh, no kidding.
It's the first photo that you encounter in the book, and it's the same poem that you'll read at the end of the book.
Right. What did the pig think of the poem?
The pig was no longer thinking when the poem was
We wondered, because they're supposed to be pretty smart.
Good critics. but the thing that fascinates me about your work, Meredith, is that you seem to be so straightforward in the instructions. You make everything sound marvelously easy. At the same time, you're philosophical and lyrical about it. How do you do that?
Oh, I think it just must come a bit naturally to me. I'm very committed to helping people understand not only how to do something, but also why it works.
Yes.
In the kitchen. You know, so I guess I have a lot of experience. I never went to culinary school, you know, but so I have experience sort of as a self-taught person, which is sort of the kind of person that I write for. You know, somebody who is interested in this stuff because they are, or they should be, and so they're going to adventure to do it on their own, and they need straightforward instruction that isn't about selling you something. It's just about open source, you know, helping you understand the food science as well as tapping into, I guess, the way that the metaphor that is cooking, you know, how it relates to the human experience. And so I guess I write to fill a gap, I feel like, that I've found in my own education, you know, and so I guess that's where it comes from.
Well, I mean, while I'm reading this book, I'm thinking to myself, you know, she's telling me how to do this, so I better actually try doing it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, because I don't generally make sausages.
Well, you wouldn't let me use Bill Ruhlman's book.
Right.
To make smoked duck or whatever it was.
You're going to hang a duck in our dirty basement.
I wanted to hang a duck in the basement because he said...
Why not?
That was how you started. Well, it's kind of grubby down there.
It's pretty grubby. No, but, you know, I had to read about the stuffing. I had to register what it is. My mother used to always make all our sausages.
Right.
And we all did it. We used, what kind of casings?
Natural hog casings.
And we had a grinder and a funnel, but we hand pushed this into the casing.
Wow!
And tied it off. It was really good. And then
I bet it was really good.
Yeah, and then you'd have to fry a piece, cook it, to say you could adjust the seasoning.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. And it was a wonderful experience, very low tech.
Yeah, and it's actually even easier now.
Why is it easier?
I would say particularly the methods for home stuffing have gotten a lot better, you know, over the years. So people are often surprised at how simple it is. I mean, there is some financing of small equipment. You know, a meat grinder and a sausage stuffer, but people are so surprised at how easy it is to grind their own meat, you know, and season it and stuff it. Because I think we've been told that sausage making is this, like, horrible, strange thing that we don't want to hear about, you know. But I go around all the time talking about how sausage is made, you know, and people are amazed at how pure it can be and how easy it can be and how creative they can become, you know, by taking on that task in their kitchen.
Who was it? Oliver Wendell Holmes, or was it somebody like that, who said there were two things you did not want to see being made, laws and sausages?
I know, isn't that funny? I agree with the laws thing, but I think everyone should know how sausage is made.
Good, good.
We have a local one, a charcuterie place, that they had a really good sausage called Mutt.
Mutt?
Mutt.
When the guy was still making it, Mutt was like $4 a pound. And the mutt consisted of what was left over from all the fillings that they had done for the last several days.
That's great.
So you had no idea what you were getting in the sausage.
Oh, what a great idea. But I love it.
It became so popular he couldn't keep up with the demand, yeah, so he stopped it.
Yeah, he stopped making it, and now he's closed anyway. So he's off.
Oh, he's off, that's too bad.
He's off doing his life's work, doing something else.
Huh.
So, but you cover such a wide range of a charcuterie. Why don't you explain some of what you cover?
In the book?
Yeah, man. I'm always interested in lardo, by the way.
Okay. Well, I kind of divide charcuterie into a few categories because I find it helps people enter into that world a little bit more easily. I think that charcuterie and any cured meats can be very daunting to people because they've heard so many different Italian and French-sounding words. Uh-huh. You know, that are meant to refer to cured meats, and they say, well, what's the same about these things and what's different about these things, you know? And yeah. So I divide it into, kind of sausage making and then curing whole muscles and then making suspensions, which is, you know, a lot like making sausages. It's just, as we said, a little bit more finicky of a process. And then there's a whole nother category that is the fermented product. So the product that's never ever cooked. And so that's kind of what I cover throughout the book, is I just break it down into those categories. And the chapters are divided according to those categories. They're just more poetically named than that. And so it goes through and gives lots of recipes for fresh sausages and then enters into how to make suspensions, such as mortadella, or terrines or pâtés, and then it goes through into whole muscle cures like prosciutto, and I'm not sure if there's a prosciutto recipe in there, but there's a culatello recipe in there.
I saw that.
Which differentiates from a prosciutto in that it is a boneless ham as opposed to a ham that's cured bone-in, and for the most part that's the difference. And so I think that helps people start to see how a lot of the words just refer to slight variation in the spices or slight variation in the cut of meat that goes into the preparation. And then there's a combination of many techniques that we can use to cure meat. And so then after that, it goes into fermentation. So kind of a culmination of all the different skills that you've learned earlier in the book. If you can top it off with making a charcuterie cabinet and air curing some salamis or a culatello, if you dare.
You know, I'm talking to you brings to mind all the characters we've met in this field.
Uh-huh. There are quite a few characters.
Yeah, we talked about the king of culatello with you.
Uh-huh.
But there was also, we went to the Museum of Jamon in Madrid, wasn't it? Madrid?
Oh, yeah, great. I've heard of that.
Which is wondrous. We couldn't figure out how every time we ordered jamon in a Spanish restaurant, we would get a staple.
Uh-huh.
They stapled these little cups to catch the liquid.
I found one here that I just absolutely had to bring to the listeners' attention. It's called chili, mustard, and pickled celery salami. And here's how she describes it. This is the craziest thing I have ever made.
It still is.
It blooms on your tongue with layers of umami and is truly unlike any other salami I've ever had. Now, did you invent it?
I did. And I'm still like, it's funny, it's one of those recipes when I was developing it that I wasn't quite sure if I wanted to put it in the book, you know, because it was so kind of off the beaten path. But everyone I gave it to said, you have to put this in the book.
It
and
looks
so
wonderful.
I did. And I'm interested to hear from readers, you know, who do adventure to make it, what they really think, because I'm honestly still on the fence about it. it's quite interesting, for sure.
It tells us something about you. So for listeners, readers, this is part of the story that makes this young lady so fascinating, is that she's prepared to disclose these kinds of feelings that she has without being the slightest bit concerned about it.
Oh, no, not at all. I despise the inflated ego of many in the culinary field, and I just want to be as absolutely flawed and human as I possibly can be for folks, you know, especially folks who aren't, you know, master chefs who just want to learn how to cook and cook well and eat well, you know, like, let's make it approachable, especially with something like charcuterie that's been, you know, elevated to this very gourmet sort of region in our minds and, you know, when it comes to our wallets. And, you know, in some ways I think that's very, very good because it offers respect to a true skill and a true craft that might otherwise get lost. But I think in other ways, like, this used to be the food of the poorest of the poor. And I think it, you know, there are a lot of very hungry people in the world, and there are a lot of, you know, people who don't get to experience deliciousness or don't get to open their palates. And I think that, you know, bringing this craft, you know, just opening all the doors to it is a really, you know, noble thing to do. And so that's what this book is really about.
We last time we were in Rome, we had lunch at a restaurant in the Testaccio region, which happened to be located right where the historical Roman city abattoir was located. And they, of course, they dealt with all four quarters and then the fifth quarter, which is all the raw material that goes into the products that you make. And apparently the way this restaurant got started was the butchers at the abattoir, they didn't get paid in money. They got paid with fifth quarter meats.
Oh, interesting.
And needless to say, if they got them earlier in the day, they certainly didn't have any way to refrigerate them. So they would take their booty across the street to this restaurant called Cecchino 1886. And Cecchino 1886 would cook it for them. So that it was safe until they could take it home.
Sure. Wow. That's awesome.
There's so many great stories surrounding.
There's amazing stories,
yes. A book, have you ever read the book on, what's it, Charcuteria, the Spanish charcuterie book?
Yes, and I actually just, I had the opportunity to learn from Chef Weiss at an event recently.
Oh, great. He's a super
guy. Yes, and so it was an event. It was Chef Weiss, and it was also Kate Hill and Dominique Chapelard from Gascony in France.
Oh, wow.
And they did, it was wonderful for me to gain perspective from all of them just about the angle that they take on butchery and the way that they preserve meat and also just stories of how the animal is valued differently in Spain and in France as it is in the United States. You know, I mean, I was fascinated to learn that in the butcher shops in France that sausages sell for the same amount of money as, you know, tougher cut roasts and also pâtés. Whereas here in America, we're just now getting people to eat pâtés, and in many cases, sausages are selling for much more money per pound than our, you know, tougher roast, you know, cuts of roast. That's just one example of how the French, you know, are valuing the animal differently, and it's subsequently making butchery and then farming a little bit more feasible, you know, for folks. So.
And you're working on the backside of that yourself, right, with your non-for-profit venture?
Yes. So it's about, I'm very interested in looking at the entire supply chain because I would like to see good food work for a lot more people than it works for right now. And so I'm interested in farming. I'm interested in the people that do farming and how they are, what their well-being and quality of life is like. And I'm also interested in, you know, the quality of the product and making good food. So I like looking at, you know, all parts of the process and seeing where we can sort of attack it to create positive change.
Well, it has been an extraordinary pleasure to connect with you again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, yes. Listeners, thank you.
I hope you get the message here that this is something that maybe you won't ever actually make anything, but you will be much more knowledgeable about what to buy.
That's true, yes.
Have a great day, Lee. Let's let you go before we breathe too many germs down the pipe here.
We can't communicate this disease to you over the phone.
Well, thank you both so much. I hope you feel better.
Oh, we must. We have to.
And have safe travels.
Thank you, and keep us in mind when you write your next book.
Oh, I will, absolutely.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And since today he's either the men's or the women's final in the Australian Open tennis tournament, We decided we'd bring you a little bit of Oz music. Two lovely young people that we met the last time we were there, which was last April at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. We ran into a lot of super duper winemakers. Two in particular were such delightful young people from the Mornington Peninsula, not more than 50 miles from the capital of Victoria, Melbourne, where the Australian Open is being played right now. I'm just going to run them back to back. It's an area that's famous for Pinot Noir, and that's exactly the wines that they're talking about.
Mike Aylward. That's kind of an unusual name. Where does that come from?
The name Aylward is Irish in heritage, so I'm Irish from maybe four generations ago, and the name itself means guardian. So it's an old Irish term called guardian, but it's actually guardian of a cemetery. So it's not as exotic as you think.
Now, the interesting thing is it doesn't have anything to do with grapes, but that's what we're going to talk about. So how did you get to grapes?
Okay. So when I was finishing school, I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I went and did a science degree. And while I was studying, I needed a part-time job, so I started working in the vineyard. And I'd work in the vineyard to earn some money. But I was working with some very passionate people. And I started to get into wines, and their enthusiasm really wore off on me. We'd do some amazing tastings on the weekends. And then I found that I was less and less interested in uni and more interested in spending more time in the vineyard.
Now, when you say we're doing wine, you're doing wine grapes in a region that, when I lived in Australia, didn't have a grape.
Yeah, right.
Never mind a wine grape.
Right.
So put it on the map for our listeners.
All right.
And then talk about how big a deal it's become. Mornington Peninsula Pinot Noir is world famous now. How did that come about?
Sure. Well, I'd say 35 to 40 years ago, there was a couple of prospectors, I guess you'd say. Nat White, Lindsay McCall, Paringa Estate. They went down to the Mornington and saw the merit in growing really good quality Pinot Noir there, as some similarities with maybe Burgundy, but a nice cool maritime climate, so a very good climate for growing Pinot Noir.
Now listen, I'm gonna embarrass this man, because the wine he has in his glass in front of me is white. So, help us out here. This is not just a one-trick pony Pinot Noir. There's more going on than that.
Well, we started 20 years ago, and 20 years ago there was a bit of a boom down Mornington way. A lot more interest came down there, and a lot more vineyard was planted, and people tried alternative varieties to Pinot Noir. Chardonnay was doing really well. But we put in some Pinot Gris, and we found that the Pinot Gris grew beautifully. We had very consistent crops and very high-quality fruit. And we had some beautiful textures coming through the wines, and we've seen an enormous amount of growth in Pinot Gris in the last 5 years, in both people producing and also what the restaurants are demanding.
Did you ever go to school to make wine?
No, I never studied. So I did more of an apprenticeship. So I spent a couple of years in the vineyard and a couple of years in the winery, and then a year out in the sales. And then I got to start off Oceanate, my own business. So I was a bit of a jack of all trades, and then I had the opportunity to start up Oceanate, which I'm really grateful for. So.
Do that again.
I'm very grateful for that opportunity. So.
And you're not only a grape grower, you're a winemaker.
Yes, so we do the whole process. So we have 27 acres of vines, and all those grapes go into Oceanate. So we grow it, we make it, we bottle it, and then we take it out to the market to sell.
And it's called Oceanate.
Oceanate.
And how do people find more information about Oceanate on the internet, I suppose?
Well, Oceanate's actually sold through a lot of the top restaurants on the east coast of Australia now, particularly our Pinot Gris. A lot of restaurants buy the glass that need a wine to match with these Asian-infused foods. Foods like, coriander, lemongrass. There's not many wines that go with these foods, but we're finding Pinot Gris is a beautiful match, and that's why there's such a big growth in this variety.
Will you be sending any of your Pinot to the rest of the world? I mean, my wife and I tasted it. It's world class. Are you thinking about that kind of scale?
I can't grow bigger than our 27 acres. I'm limited there. But having said that, I have travelled to Japan's a really nice market for us. Off the Japanese subtle foods, we make subtle wines and they go really beautifully with the Japanese foods. And also the UK is a great market as well. So we are selling overseas, but we're starting to run out of volume. Our wines are doing very well in the Melbourne and Sydney restaurants. So.
Well, I guess there's only one word to say, right? It's called cheers.
Cheers, mate.
Business is called Equal Time. So we talked to Mike a little bit ago about Pinot Noir and Pinot Grigio in the Mornington Peninsula. It turns out his vineyard has a neighbor, and Laurie works at that neighborly wine producer. First of all, explain quickly the geography of the Mornington Peninsula. Where is it exactly?
So it's about an hour's drive from Melbourne. Beautiful coastlines, rolling hills, open paddocks. It's often called the lungs of Melbourne. A lot of people come down to holiday for the beautiful beaches, the wonderful vineyards, which are known for producing great Pinot Noir, Chardonnay and Pinot Gris. In my opinion, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world, and that's why I live there.
You were born there as well, or you were fortunate enough to be there all this time?
Yeah, born and raised on the Mornington Peninsula, and in fact I love it so much that I don't think I will ever move.
To just put it on kind of a dot of the map, there's a place where a lot of tourists go called Phillip Island, where there are penguins that kind of trot across the street at particular times of the day. Is that sort of on the way to Mornington?
So there's a southeast touring triangle, so a lot of people will travel from Phillip Island to the Mornington Peninsula and then on to the Bellarine Peninsula in Geelong. So it's quite close by, so you could do it in a few days trip, so even incorporate it into something for the Great Ocean Road, so it's really accessible. We don't have anything like penguins. We do have some beautiful dolphins in the ocean and some great snorkeling places as well. But it's, for me, it's got much more than what Phillip Island offers. It's like a little epicurean paradise. There's wonderful wineries around every corner, amazing places to eat. It's often called Little Italy because it's just, full of these amazing producers of food and wine, and it's just so centrally focused in our culture.
How did it begin? Everything has to have a beginning. And when I lived in Geelong, just across the waters of Port Phillip Bay, there were no grapes. So were there a number of individuals who just decided we can grow grapes here?
So me being only 27 years of age, I don't have a huge knowledge of the background of the area, although I do know of one particular producer who back in the 80s introduced Pinot Gris to our region because she thought she'd just give it a shot. She planted a whole heap of vines and tried her hand at it, and she is the one sole person who introduced that varietal to our region, and it's now in over 100 wineries in the area. So, yeah, as simple as somebody starting something up and planting some vines, but it was well known as an agricultural area.
But the grape that sort of seduced the world at large, including the United States where we live, is Pinot Noir.
So the Pinot Noir, again, I don't know a lot about the history of how this started. I do know that we have one particular clone of grape, the MV6, which is the backbone of the Mornington Peninsula. So the wines from our region have a really characteristic style to them because of this particular clone that we use. In addition to that, because we're a maritime climate, we get some really beautiful flavours coming through our wine.
Laurie, thank you so much for talking to us this evening. And you and Mike will be stars of our program upcoming. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wouldn't you just love to have a glass of that wonderful Pinot Noir in your hand right now?
Certainly would.
Okay, well, we'll fix that later today.
In the
meantime, we'll hope to see you same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.